Resident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff. I'll be with you for the next hour on this November the 19th on the West Coast, now November the 20th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. I'd also like to welcome those not just listening in on bbsradio.com, but on Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world. And we appreciate the support, not just in the live broadcast, but even in the rebroadcasts that I hear about from my good buddy Drew Raines throughout the day, all week long. I'm really thrilled that you're getting something out of this show. As is my habitual practice of late, I've been playing music at the outset of the show. We've been going into the heart center. We've been talking about things in respect to who we are in relationship to the universe, our consciousness. And I've gotten a lot of nice compliments from people on the music. I've been featuring primarily the singing of a 7-year-old girl this week. And she's going to be one heck of a star as the years go on. Hopefully, she's going to be that shining star from heaven and keep her contribution to the world and her work, because she's teaching us, believe it or not, a 7-year-old is teaching us how to listen to God. And she's very gifted. I'm speaking about Rayma Marvan from Carrollton, Texas. And I'm going to continue this, I think. A lot of times I open the show with a speech or some political comment or a clip from a news feed, something like that, where we want to stress what we're hearing and what we're not hearing and sort it all out so we understand what's really going on. And I know that music is probably preferable to listening to a lot of the negative stuff. And I'm going to, before we get into our conversation tonight with our guest, scientist, inventor, Jim Murray, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to play something a little bit different from what I've been playing lately. And play a really cool track by the keyboardist and composer, arranger, producer, Michael Omardian. And this is one of his originals called Say Something. Michael Omardian and Say Something. That's from a compilation disc called Organized. And it's some of the baddest organists on the planet playing a Hammond B3. And I may play another track from that album before the show ends. I got something else crazy off of that disc. So we're going to say something. With that, I bring back to Evident Footprints our regular Friday night co-host and guest. And he is a scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, and our good friend and resident science advisor, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hey, Don, thank you. And incidentally, I enjoyed that opening piece very much.
Oh, you mean the theme song or the... No, I'm just kidding. Yeah,
not the theme song. I've heard that before. No, this organ piece was very nice. I only have one negative comment. I couldn't make out the words.
Especially in the second verse, right? Yeah.
No, it was a good piece.
Yeah. And I know it's difficult for you to hear everything that's happening because you're listening in mono on a telephone, so you have a really restricted bandwidth and frequency response. But I know that, like me, you have actually worked technically in some recording studios, haven't you? And that's something that we share in common.
Yeah, actually, I used to design and build mixing consoles for several of the big studios that used to be in New York back in the early 60s. Don Elliott Productions, Tavi Andriello Recordings, West End Recordings, there were a few of them. And I enjoyed it very much. It was a very nice business.
Yeah. So when you talk about frequencies, you're not just a guy talking about readings on an oscilloscope or a frequency analyzer. You're actually hands-on in terms of knowing what music sounds like and how it works and setting up the infrastructure for producing music.
Well, actually, I have a very good ear for music. My biggest problem is I just never had the opportunity to do anything, you know, with it as a career or even as an advanced interest. But I inherited a lot of that from my folks. My mother and dad both were very highly appreciative of good music, and they both were pianists, I might add.
Hmm. Well, like my family, everyone in my family was or is a musician, and many of us play more than one instrument, too.
So. Yeah, you told me that. That's really remarkable. Actually, you know, I wanted to play the violin more than anything. And my dad told me it was too complicated, and he would start me with the piano. And, of course, there were two things that were against me in that regard. I couldn't stand the piano teacher, couldn't communicate with him. And that just shut me down completely. And, of course, the other thing was that I didn't like the idea of being forced to play the piano when I didn't really want to play it.
Mm-hmm.
So those two things worked against me. I have a quick little anecdote that I could report on that very subject. I couldn't read the musical notes at all. I still can't. And I tried to get the guy to explain it to me so I could understand it, and it didn't work. So just to gain points with the man, I memorized everything, and I memorized like two complete books just by listening to him play and then me playing them, you know. So One day he brings in a completely new book, and he opens it up to the first piece, and he says, go ahead and play this. And I said, well, aren't we going to go over it together? And he goes, no, of course not. It's right there. You can read the music. I said, no, I can't. So anyway, he got really ticked off because there was about 3 or 4 months involved where I was doing nothing but memorizing this stuff. And so he got pretty belligerent and began chasing me around the house. And I opened the door and ran down the hallway into the main part of the house, away from the living room. And he was stupid enough to follow me. And we had a 120-pound German police dog who saw this stranger chasing me down the hallway. And he proceeded to tear the pants right off the guy.
Maybe I should have opened.
Literally, I mean, literally tear them off, along with a good deal of flesh. And so that was the last lesson that I had. That's how it remained.
Now I'm thinking I should have opened with Gnarls Barkley's Crazy, but I'll do that another time. You'll understand why. Well, that guy sounds like he was crazy. If he was the teacher that he thought he was, he would have just taken what little bit he had to work with from his level, and nurtured your ability to basically photograph the music in your mind, you know. And during that time, you know, if he was a good teacher, he could teach you how to read music. I could teach anyone in about 5 minutes all the principles of reading music. Now, getting good at it requires practice. But
well, the thing with me, the way my mind works, and it, believe me, this has been both a blessing and a hindrance throughout my life. If I don't understand something completely down to the roots level, forget it. It's not going to stay. And I kept asking the guy, I don't know what the notes mean. I don't know what they relate to. I don't see the purpose of it. I don't see how it interrelates with anything. And he said, don't worry about that. Just listen to what I'm telling you. Well, I listened, but it had no meaning for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are frequencies. There are specific frequencies, but you're not learning them by number. You're learning a different system, and it's a pretty simple system. Actually,
well,
you know.
I still remember some of his comments about intervals and, you know, and then there was sharps and flats and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, it was all gobbledygook to me. So it didn't stick.
Well, someday, Jim, I'll teach you to read. OK. And then you'll say, well, now I can do it. And those days will be over.
You teach me how to do that, and I'll teach you some of the things I know. And it'll be a nice trade off.
All right. Now, on our last couple of shows, we were talking about your career and the work that you've done and the obstacles that you've had to overcome for many, many years, and the ignorance that you've had to overcome, not on your part, but on the part of the mainstream scientific community. And, of course, there were always exceptions. I don't mean to sound like you look down upon all other scientists, and I think that just your, let's say, your passion for what you do, and to really understand what makes things tick, is what allowed you to go outside the box and make some discoveries. And on our last show, we touched upon cold fusion. Prior to that, we've been talking about your electrical inventions and your experiences in those areas, which are quite remarkable in and of themselves. You can make a full feature movie, theatrical movie, on some of the things that you've done. I know that you want to discuss this topic of cold fusion again, and share with the audience your thoughts as to where it should be or where it may be going in the near future, we'll say, for sake of reference.
Well, it's not so much the cold fusion process itself that I want to talk about, Don, because to be real honest with you, I've not gotten into that in any great depth. But I have had a lot of interesting conversations with people who have attempted to duplicate the process. I looked for a common denominator in the things that the people were doing and relate that back to the original work that was done by, what was it, Pons and Fleischmann, or I forget their names. I think that's what it was. And the thing that sticks in my mind the most is the fact that there was no common denominator involved as far as the waveforms and the power supplies are concerned. And in my humble opinion, and I could be wrong about this, I really think that those people that did achieve anomalous results in their investigations were inadvertently making use of some of Tesla's discoveries on the power supply side. And without being aware of the effects that stuff like that can have, they're concentrating only on understanding the nuclear reactions and the ionic reactions. And as a result of that, I think they missed the boat. And the reason I say this is because I think you know I worked for 3 years with Professor Brown. And once I got involved with his Brown's gas project, I was in a position for quite some time to experiment with the waveforms that were used in releasing and creating Brown's gas. And the interesting thing is that the more highly filtered the power supplies were, the less yield you had of high quality gas. And the more I contemplate on that, the more it allows me to relate it to the things that Tesla talked about. Now, the thing of it is, you know, Tesla had a very wide spectrum of interests, and so do I. And so I have a tendency to see things sometimes that other people don't necessarily get. And to me, whether I'm working with mechanical vibrations, let's say, or electrical, you know, frequencies and currents and things of that sort, there's very little difference between them except for the medium that's involved. And so I can look at an experiment, let's say, that's done in acoustics or done, you know, in the electrical domain, and transfer a great deal of that information over into the area of mechanical vibrations. And that's exactly the point that I wanted to make on this. You know, Tesla discovered this wave, and it's got really, really special properties to it. And it took me years, and I'm not exaggerating, many, many years to understand what this wave was and how he found it. And the interesting thing is, once you actually isolate what he's talking about from some of his lectures, and you go and try it, and you see that it has validity to it, all of a sudden, his work takes on a completely different meaning. Because now when you read this stuff, you're reading between the lines with a certain assurance that what you're reading is correct, since you've just gone and done it. And I think that's where a lot of people who read Tesla's stuff don't make it into the deeper meaning, is because they miss all these things. And a lot of his lectures in particular are written in such a way that they definitely have a double case meaning. You know, it's almost like the original hieroglyphs that were written by the early dynasties in Egypt. They had an upper and lower case meaning. You know, if you were just somebody with a vague interest in what was going on, like in the public domain, you could read the hieroglyphs and get something out of it. Mm-hmm. But you would never get what the initiated people would get, who knew the secondary meanings of those same glyphs. When they read it, they got a totally different message. And that's exactly what I think the story is with a lot of Tesla's work. And the reason I'm bringing this up, incidentally, is because this idea of the Tesla wave, which is a fantastic wave, and it's actually used as a forcing function in most of Tesla's higher experimental work. And the effect that it has is pretty extraordinary, because the waveform itself is designed in such a way that it literally compensates for the losses that would normally be encountered in the medium in which you are working.
Yeah, Jim, I wanted to ask you a question, if I can interrupt for a moment. And it's about the wave, actually. Before you started going into this description, I wanted to ask if it's a wave that is recognized by a particular frequency and then a particular pattern that's maybe unusual to the types of waves that we're used to seeing, like on an oscilloscope, say a sine wave or a square wave or a sawtooth wave or an inverted sawtooth wave or combinations thereof. Is there a visual representation that can be produced that hones in on what this wave is?
There actually is, okay, but it has not. It's not so easy to understand what it is without giving away the whole thing, and I'm not ready to do that, especially on the air. But what I can tell you about it, which is remarkably interesting, the wave has a harmonic content which is so unusual that when you view it on the oscilloscope, it looks like a sinusoid, but it isn't. And if you don't have your scope set right and you look at this thing, you can jump to the conclusion that it's just like any other sine wave. And you make an adjustment here and there to get it to the way you're used to looking at it. And once you do that, then you'll never find the truth. But the interesting thing about it is that it actually compensates for the losses that are going to be incurred in a given circuit. And as a result of doing that, under the right conditions, the resulting power that moves through the system is extraordinarily different from the norm.
Yeah. And could you describe this wave possibly, and maybe you don't want to answer this, but as a three-dimensional wave as opposed to a two-dimensional wave?
Well, actually, all waveforms, if you really understand what they are three-dimensional. And what's interesting about it is that the so-called sine wave that everybody talks about is really a projection from three space into two space of what the real wave looks like. Now, if you want to talk about, just to get that point across, if you want to digress a little bit and just talk about a normal propagating wave and how it relates to a sine wave and what its real wave shape is, that's easy for me to do because it doesn't interfere with my work and the information is already out there someplace.
Yeah.
But basically...
Well, the reason I asked that question is because as you were describing this, I was having sort of a vision of a vortexian shape, you know.
Well, that's interesting that you did, and I'll tell you why. As a matter of fact, I'm about to tell you what that relates to. If you look at an ordinary sine wave in plotted, let's say, on a Cartesian coordinate system, if you can envision that as a shadow, and in your mind say, well, what is it a shadow of? What you actually have to have in three space with the light projecting through it in order to give you a sine wave in two space is a spiral. And so the sine wave is actually our interpretation in our plane of what the real movement is in three space. And you actually run into this in generator work, only people don't get it. Inside a generator, which is spinning, you actually have electron motion, which is a lot more complex than what people are willing to understand. And when you pipe it out of the generator into, let's say, a wire and bring it to a resistive load or something like that, and you look at it on a scope, what you're actually seeing on the scope is a two-dimensional projection of what's really happening in the generator, which is a three-space machine.
Yes.
It's occupying three dimensions. The difference gets back to what Tesla was always talking about, where you have a relativistic situation between the reference frame that's rotating with the armature of that generator versus the reference frame of the observer, which is not rotating with respect to the generator's axis of rotation. And so what we see here and the power that we use here is actually only a shadow of what's truly available. And getting to the next level of understanding of that whole thing brings you to exactly where you wanted to go with your intuition. Mm-hmm. And what that's all about is this. If you look at a vortex, lay a vortex on its side, for instance,
yes,
with the funnel end shape, in other words, the narrowest part of it, let's say to the left, and the widest part of it to the right.
Yeah.
And you now project the light through that onto a piece of paper. What you'll see is a logarithmic decrement. And it can be either a growth pattern or a diminishing pattern, depending on which way you flip the vortex. And so the thing that's interesting is that the vortex in two space actually coincides with the activity that occurs in the dampening of an electrical circuit. Or in the starting transient, depending on which way you look at it. And so it just comes right back to what we've been saying for the longest time, that, we are perceiving an illusion, which is only part of the truth, and yet we insist on building an entire technology on this illusion. And then we're really baffled by the fact that we don't have a hook into reality. And, it's a very strange thing that the mind can be entrapped like that.
What I would like to say is that when I made the statement about, is it two-dimensional or is it three-dimensional, I was referring to how it looks on the scope. And I guess the scope is limited, let's say an oscilloscope is limited. If you're running an analog signal through it, you're going to get an analog image, and it's going to be two-dimensional. But in the digital realm, especially in music, say, for instance, I'm mastering a song for a client or for myself, and I want to look at the ambient field of the music. In other words, the music is represented by the space and the area in which all the music is being performed in. And you can create this illusion. And when I bring up a plug-in that allows me to look at the room ambience, let's say I'm using a plate reverberation or a room reverberation, you immediately get a funnel shape, like you described, the point being to the left and opening to the right. And you can change the dimensions of that, and you change all of the characteristics of how the music operates within that new ambience. So you can make the room sound larger, you can cause the reverberation to reflect or to suddenly stop, and you can control the time in which it does that. And I'm thinking to myself, if we could tap into that in terms of translating that into different ways of producing energy, think of the possibilities that there would be. I don't know if I'm making myself clear, but
you're making yourself clear, and in order to exemplify exactly where that line of reasoning leads you, I'd like to just take the next step in this presentation and mention remind the listeners of the experiment that Tesla was doing in his Houston Street laboratory when he wrecked most of Lower Manhattan with a miniature earthquake. He was using vibrations of the type that that I was attempting to describe.
Mm-hmm.
And they automatically compensate for the losses that the signal would normally incur passing down through the steel structure of his building into the bedrock of Manhattan and then finally reflecting back to the point where they started to build an intensity. Now, Tesla talked about the fact that if you really understood this phenomenon, that you could topple some huge building, you know, just with a small device that would fit under a derby hat. And you would just have to bolt it to the appropriate place and get it going into resonance, and it would bring the whole building down. And a lot of people can't buy that because they realize that in normal situation, the dampening factor is so severe that there's no way that anything could approach pure resonance, especially with such a modest input of power as he described. And there's this show on TV, Mythbusters, I think it's called. And
yes.
A friend of mine sent me a tape that they had where there was this bridge that they were going to demolish. I think it was in Boston someplace. And before they were going to dynamite this bridge, it was an old steel truss bridge, an open truss, very nice little railroad bridge. And before they demolished it, these guys got permission to attach a Tesla oscillator to this bridge and, you know, and fire it up. I think they powered it with compressed air. And the whole idea was to see if they could demolish the bridge without the use of the dead cord and the other explosives that are normally involved. So they got permission to do this. And they did the whole thing and recorded it for their TV show. And, of course, nothing happened. So their comment was that they had debunked the whole Tesla mystery about bringing down big buildings with this small little oscillator because they couldn't even get the bridge to shake. But the interesting thing is they weren't even doing what Tesla was doing. They were doing what they thought he was doing, which is something entirely different. And so just the small difference, and it is a relatively small difference, between Tesla's waveform and the classical waveforms associated with simple harmonic motion make it impossible to duplicate the effect unless you know exactly what you're doing. And
now,
it's very interesting that the whole world seems to work that way.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is they have a partial glimpse of reality, and somehow it becomes the whole picture.
Can the principle of how this wave works or operates be controlled and adapted to different types of technology that can be, let's say, joined together in a process, let's say, like in a vehicle, where maybe you're using Brown's gas and a dual synchronous capacitor or something along that line to sort of work together to produce the power in a productive way?
Well, I don't see why not. I've experimented with this phenomenon mostly in the electrical realm, somewhat in the mechanical realm, and I have friends who have played with the same process in acoustics and in the area of light.
Mm-hmm.
And it works fine every time. The interesting thing, of course, is that you have to retain the basic knowledge and also have the greater understanding necessary to make the transition, let's say, from an electrical example of the phenomenon into the optical example or the acoustical example, which requires not only different equipment, but different ways of actually manifesting the principle.
Yeah.
But if you understand that, you can definitely do what you're talking about, and you can cascade the effects.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Because you know my interest in let's say, changing sound into light or light into sound. And the reason one would want to do that is to get rid of corrupt politicians. You know, actually, it probably would have some effect on them. But let's say for healing applications. I think in a way that I may have tapped into that concept without really realizing what it is. In terms of Tesla's research, it might be the same thing, you know. So I would be interested in learning more about that.
Well, there's a lot of things I'd be happy to share with you privately, but I'm really a little bit reluctant, especially since I do have some investors behind me. It wouldn't be a good idea to just blurt out all this stuff on, you know, to millions of listening ears when, you know, they imagine themselves as having a monopoly on the procedure. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
But I'm happy to talk about the results of doing it. And also, there are a lot of misconceptions involved in what is really happening in these different circuits. And if you don't understand, well, not only circuits, but different systems that operate this way.
Yes.
And if you don't understand those things, it's just not going to happen. I've had so many people that I've talked to try and clarify this over the years, and it's amazing that they get totally belligerent about this stuff. They can't just discuss it, you know, in a matter-of-fact manner, you know, based on scientific and logical principles. Always the emotions come in. And it's almost like it's a reflection of what Reich talked about when he said that if you lead an armored human being too close to the, what you might call the borders of his concepts of reality, you'll get a violent reaction because they don't want to go beyond that comfort zone.
Oh yeah, and I think that's fear induced, and the fear produces the denial, you know, that could be, or that you know what you're talking about, and what they'd have to learn. You know, they have to face how little they understand.
Yeah, but none of us know a damn thing. I could never really understand that attitude. You know, you just pit yourself against the Creator in anything you want to, and you don't know a thing. So why is there all this ego flying around? It doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's the illusion. It has to play and fit into all the other illusions that we experience day to day, right?
Well, I guess so, but to be honest with you, I'm glad I'm not there. I've walked away from that a long time ago.
Yeah, I understand. Well, it still serves a purpose to talk about it and mention it, because that's the reality of what we're facing. People don't understand why we're using primitive combustion methods to power vehicles around the planet when there is much more advanced technology that doesn't have to cost as much money and have as many negative effects on the environment and on the planet and the galaxy and the universe. You know, they're just throwing all the universal laws out the window, or flushing them down the toilet as if they're not important, or there's no significant responsibility on the back end of this game that they're playing, you know, when it comes to a point where the beings that are doing the things they're doing on this planet to destroy it and to control and undermine the progress of mankind's spiritual evolvement. They're really just sabotaging their own future because they're eventually going to have to pay for it.
Well, you know what that reminds me of? When I was a kid, my grandmother used to tell this ridiculous little story, but I never forgot it, and it does have application right here. She tells a story about this mother who's watching the parade because her son is one of the soldiers in the battalion that's on display. And finally she sees him coming along, and you know, his footwork is an atrocity. And so she says, "Oh, look, they're all out of step except my little Johnny." And, you know, and that's exactly how this planet operates. It's so stupid. I mean, you've got this entire universe that's working in resonance and in cooperation with the laws that were established for its creation. But this planet is on its own, and of course everybody else is wrong.
Yeah, this planet is the only one that's in step.
Yeah, right. But with what?
Itself. And even not that, you know. Well, you know, I hope you don't mind my interjecting those questions, because when I consider the things that you talk about from week to week, you know, I have flashes of ideas that come and go throughout the next week until we begin the show. And sometimes they're just momentary, and then I don't give them a second thought. And then you say something, and I go back to that very thought that I had. And that happens with us a lot in our discussions, whether on the air or in private. And I think a lot of that happens because we're open to possibilities. You know, we're not starting out the gate with shackles around our neck and earplugs on and blinders. You know, we're willing to listen to anything or consider anything, the possibility that something could be, that it could exist, could have been done already, probably billions or even trillions of times throughout the universe. These things have been done before. Someone's come to this stage in their history, and they've overcome it, or they've been destroyed. And it's really insane to think that someone would actually intentionally choose the wrong path, you know, knowing what they know, or what they profess to know. You would think that they would intentionally choose the right path, because they're going to have to face up to it eventually. It's sort of like we pay now, Jim, but they pay later.
And yeah, I understand that. But, you know, I also have mused with considerable interest and curiosity on a related issue to that. I'm pretty sure that if you go up the ladder high enough in this gangster cabal that's running this planet, you're going to find individuals who are fully aware of cosmic law. They know exactly what's going on. They've chosen to do what they want to do because they want to do it. But that doesn't mean they don't know the truth.
Well, now, of course. That's what I'm saying.
And here's the part that's mysterious to me. If they know that much about it and they really understand karma, how do they expect to get out of the karmic loop? That's the strangest thing about the whole deal to me, because if they really understand all this, just imagine the karma that you can accumulate by killing off millions of people and causing plagues and the lies and the stealing and the cheating and the murdering that goes on. And that all flows uphill to whoever's at the top. How does that individual expect to have any kind of a meaningful incarnation the next time around? unless they really are stupid enough to think that they're going to live forever or something like that and sidestep these laws. I don't think the universe makes exceptions for thugs.
No. In fact, Jim, what you're describing is nothing more than insanity. To not recognize and honor what you know, but to use it to further your depraved goals. You know, it's insane to know that and still act as though that has no bearing, that has no significance, no accountability somewhere down the road. No,
yeah, it always reminds me of a guy who has spent his whole life dealing with chemistry and physics and things like that and welding and the strength of metals and what have you. And all of a sudden he just takes it upon himself to go and get a cutting torch, and he's going to burn a hole into this gigantic tank that's full of hydrogen gas. You know, he's not concerned. It's like, well, what about the stuff you know? Well, it doesn't apply here. I mean, to me, that's the kind of thing that's being done. It's just nuts.
Well, yeah, and they're investing a lot of time into trying to keep us along that path. You know, it's our nature to move in an opposite direction. Why? Because to some extent, we have a soul and a heart. And all the things that come with that, and to lack that, and I'm not speaking in a physical sense. I'm speaking in a spiritual sense. Those are the supreme laws anyway. You know, it doesn't matter what we do in the physical. The spiritual laws dictate how the physical laws operate. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, that's one of the key things that I have focused on throughout my entire career. I believe completely that the things that go on in the spiritual realm, whatever they may be, are simply higher octaves of the expression of the same laws that we see here. They're just operating one octave or two octaves or whatever it is up the ladder from our perception. But they are the same thing operating in different levels. And that's the reason why so many philosophers have said through the years that if there's going to be a physical change, whether it's in your body, your health, or something in the world that's making an appearance, this precipitates on our level from a spiritual happening that has already occurred on a higher level. And,
oh,
you know,
yes,
when you stop to think of it, that's really what's going on. That's what life's all about. It's the manifestation of thought forms in such a way that there is interaction between all of the beings that are participating, not only from the standpoint of how it affects them in their physical lives, but also how they have pre-planned all this stuff in concert with the higher laws on a spiritual level.
We could say that that's the multiverse, couldn't we?
Yeah, of course, because, you know, we're only looking at one small aspect of the real reality. There was, I think I mentioned to you once or twice during the course of our association, that I had a really dear friend named Dominic Lucchesi many years ago.
Oh, yeah, and you mentioned it a couple of weeks ago. Yeah.
Well, I know I've mentioned him more than once. But he had showed me this book that he had, and I can't remember the exact name of it, but I think it was something like Spiritual Chemistry or something to that effect. And the thing that was so amazing about it was that whoever the author was had taken the time to look at a particular molecule, let's say sugar, for instance, And then using his intuition, he would imagine what that looked like on a higher plane of existence. And so that you would see in this book page after page of diagrams where at the bottom of the page or just above the text that explained the picture, you would see the standard molecular arrangement, let's say, for sugar. And then toward the top of the page, you would see what the spiritual aspect of that thing had to look like in order for the sugar molecule to exist the way it does on our plane.
Mm-hmm.
And what was fascinating about it was he did the same thing toward the end of the book with various organs in the body. And I don't remember all of them, but I do remember the picture of the heart. And the thing that was interesting about the heart is that the three-dimensional heart that we have beating in our chest is actually the very, very bottom tip of this amazing structure which extends up into the spiritual realm.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not just the physical thing, you know, it's this whole continuum that exists between the higher expression and the gross matter that we're familiar with.
Now, it's funny you should mention that. Not humorous funny, but let's say peculiar in a sense, because my take on what's happening to the average human is that we are opening up our consciousness to that very thing you just described. It is real, and I think the problem is that we are sort of like filtering out that energy, or it's, you know, the belief systems, the matrix, the mind control, the toxins, all the things that affect us in a negative way are actually shutting down the pathways for us to open up to all that energy. And I think that's occurring on a much higher level, whether we like it or not. It's happening.
That just supports what we said earlier, that things that happen in the spiritual world filter down and precipitate into changes in our world, and there's not much you can do about it, especially if it's preordained. And I really hope it is.
Yes. Yes. Well, Jim, before we end the show, I want to, if I can, ask you to join me in sharing another song with the listeners. And, you know, this is to break up the energy. This is a really funky song. It's very jazzy. It's another organ piece from this CD called Organized. And this is a guy named Ricky Peterson and a song called Drop Shot. Would you like to hear that, Jim?
Yeah, I'm actually very fond of organ music, to be honest with you.
Okay, all right. Drop Shot. Here we go. We'll be right back. You know, Jim, Drop Shot by Ricky Peterson is sort of a musical example of what we were talking about tonight. And this is the darndest thing, because I have picked this song out as a possible track to play at this part of the show, not knowing where our conversation was going to go. And as I listened to this song, from a musical standpoint, I was listening to a group of musical scientists who had agreed to step outside the matrix melodically, harmonically, and rhythmically, which are the three primary elements of music, and play with soul, with spirit, enter that multidimensional realm. And this is sort of an example of the technology in an abstract way that we've been talking about, and these scientific principles. Would you like to comment on that? Tell me I'm crazy, or it's my
I wouldn't say that at all. As a matter of fact, you know, I was even going to ask you this question earlier, and right after you played the opening song to the show, and we just didn't get to it. There was quite a few nice pieces that I used to listen to back in the late 50s, early 60s, which still elevate my spirit every time I hear it. And I think they were probably somewhat innovative for their time. Do you remember one was called The Happy Organ, and another one was called Patricia? And they were just really... For me, they were just very special pieces.
Yes,
some of the elements that are in this piece you just played actually brought that back to my mind. There are some similarities.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what we heard, I mean, there's a lot of, it sounds to the average person like the musicians are jumping around and, you know, playing stuff offbeat. Well, there is some odd meter grooves in there, and rhythmic inflection and syncopation, those are the abnormal phenomena that occur in music, but they liberate the soul. And they touch upon realms that bring other energies to us through that music. And if we could develop a tolerance in general as a mass of beings that have a certain amount of consciousness, we could raise the consciousness with this type of music. Even though to some people, you know, they think, oh no, only classical music can do that. Or, you know, it's got to be Frank Sinatra or Ella Fitzgerald or a country artist. I think all music has a potential to touch upon these principles if people would get out of tradition, what's acceptable for the day, you know, sort of like what shoes are acceptable, or what jeans are acceptable, or what kind of t-shirt's acceptable, or a coat, or a hat, or gloves, or a car, you know. All these things that are not of us, we identify with as if they make us who we are, and we're really missing the whole boat. So I understand what you're saying in that respect, that when you touch upon those real elements that touch our souls, we're reminded of those, you see. They spring up forth from our subconscious into the conscious realm for us to examine. And I think it allows us to expand when we expand our horizons in that regard. I think it would be the same in art and certainly in science. You know, all of this stuff.
Oh, definitely, definitely. It's the same thing. About 6 or 8 months ago on TV, they were pushing this collection of rock songs from the 50s, and this guy Bowser, who used to have a musical group called Sha-na-na, he was one of the principal characters doing the advertisement. And the thing that was interesting was just so true. I mean, he had this girl with him, and they were doing the advertisement together, but she made a comment, or maybe he did, that the songs, when you hear them, they have the ability to not only to transport you in time back to that era, but you not you not only remember what you were doing when you heard that song, of course, a lot of that was, you know, making out in a car or something, but the other thing is that it's got the ability to spiritually pull you so that you have a reliving of the feelings from that time.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the reasons why when people get older, they have such a propensity to buy these rock collections and these classic collections, whether they be country rock or whatever, you know, from the 50s, 60s, and 70s, is just mm-hmm. because they want to relive those very moments that they cherished a long time ago and the feelings that go with them. The interesting thing is that is the mechanism with which we're talking about, and the way in which it's used right now is only the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah. Now, this brings up a whole new topic for a show, and that's that I see continuously this bombardment of our past. In other words, I don't really see anything going on in reverting back to an awareness or a remembrance of the past as being negative. But if you don't allow the same freedom in terms of envisioning and creating the future, then it has a negative context or a negative impact. And I think that's what's happening to mankind, is we're reverting back into our past so much that we're almost, or we are, afraid to move into the future and the awareness that really everything is an eternal now, that the past is really an illusion, and in a sense the future is an illusion, and all we have to do is expand outward from the center of the now. Do you agree with that, or do you want to comment on that?
Oh, I do agree with it, actually. But I think that the thing that captivates my interest the most about what we were just talking about is that, see, it's easy for us, in a certain respect, to use music as a mechanism or as a bridge to pull us back to something in the past that we loved and cherished, which is now missing from our lives.
Yes.
And that's the normal tendency in that regard of making use of that particular mechanism. But I think that in the early days of the church, when they were investigating certain types of music, like Gregorian chant, for instance, mm-hmm. and certain of the hymns that were created and sung in Latin and things of that sort, that what they were actually doing was pulling in the other direction, not necessarily into the future in the way that we like to think about future with respect to past, but rather to elevate the spirit to the point where you are gravitating toward something more ultimate, something more grandiose than you know you are yourself. And that's one of the things that I think has disappeared out of our culture, probably by design, I might add. But
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
I was going to say
that concept of elevating the spirit by the use of music to the point where you have an uncontrollable emotional reaction is a very, very special and intense experience that is based on a science. And you know much more about that than me.
Yeah, I agree with what you said. I tend to look at, and it's funny you mentioned this, because it was either early this morning I had this conversation with someone, or yesterday afternoon, I can't recall, but we were talking about Gregorian chant and the fact that even though there was something spiritual about it, I look upon it as having been so structured that nothing outside of that was acceptable. You know, that was the accepted music. And now, that didn't mean that there weren't gypsies out there writing songs and or wandering minstrels who were creating music, or secular music as well. But Gregorian chant seemed to take control of the people through the religious implications of the music. And I see it being very structured and limited in that sense. At the same time, yes, the intention was to create a feeling of spirituality or possibly even genuinely lead one towards an awareness of the creation. But it was very limited in musical terms in that respect.
Well, so, I can understand that, but I also think that, like everything else that we have use as a measuring stick in modern times, it has to be looked at in a certain way to be understood in its totality. Because a lot of that music was actually designed to be played and set and sung within the confines of a cathedral.
Yes.
And the design and the physical structure of the cathedral was part of the overall effect. And so it was like an attempt at a gestalt that would have the elevating effect, because the beauty of the cathedral on the optical senses and the grandeur of the whole thing combined with the music, the whole thing seems to become like a transporting mechanism. Now, granted, this was all done simply to put money in the coffers of the early church, but that's beside the point. They were making use of information that allows mankind to couple into higher spiritual realms, regardless of what their motives were.
Yeah. Yeah. In a sense, I can think back to, you know, music school. And when they studied Gregorian chant in a classroom, you see, you weren't in that environment that you just described. You were in another place that maybe had a little bit of room reverberation, but not that continuous 5 or 7 second flow of sound moving through space and the overtones and the harmonics that are created from that. It was treated very dryly. And as it was taught, you know, they didn't touch upon the spiritual aspects of it. It was mathematics, parallel fourths, parallel fifths, octaves, thirds, you know, very, very, very simple, and non-harmonic and non-rhythmic, in its modality. Yes, you could say, technically there is a rhythm if the notes have a certain number of beats, but not in the sense of a pulse, let's say, okay? So I'm just making some esoteric comments, you know, about the art and how I interpret it. You know, I'm not against it. I don't hate it. It's pretty cool if it's done in the right environment, if it's performed correctly and with the understanding of how it would have been performed in the days of King Gregory. You know, so I'm in agreement. But, Jim, we could do a whole show on that, as I said.
maybe we should, you know. A lot of that stuff, too, especially the blending of the different the blending of the different stimuli which affect the senses and the use of harmonics, not only in sound, but in light and in color and in even in the ratios of physical form. All of that can be traced back to Egypt and probably earlier. And one of the greatest people that contributed So understanding all of that was a guy by the name of Schwalla de Lubitz. And if you really want to get into it, you should read his book called The Cathedral of Man. It represents like 30 years of study on how the ancient Egyptians perceived reality. And the thing that's so interesting about it is you talk about being outside the box. This guy is literally despised by classical Egyptologists because they're nowhere compared to what he understood about that culture. And it's just amazing to me that they'd rather hold on to, you know, the cherished teachings of a very limited form of science than to see what was really going on. You know, it's the same story all the time. Mankind enjoys being limited for some reason, and they don't have to be.
Yes. Well, Jim, we're out of time. It's been a really enlightening show for me, fun and thought-provoking as well, and I hope it was for you and our listening audience. You're going to be back with us again next week, I presume?
Well, I hope so.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to wish you a good night and thank you for your contribution to Evident Footprints, and have a great weekend, and I look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you very much, Don. Look forward to being with you.
All right, folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com and tonight's guest, scientist inventor Jim Murray. Special thanks also to Wind Talkers Radio Network. And I want to also thank over at bbsradio.com on the sound tonight, Seth Hendrick, Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Have a great weekend, but don't forget to tune in next Monday when my special guest will be Dr. H. Wu Ott. In the meantime, I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light. And have a good night. Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth.